Colorado and today Central Florida. Welcome to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. And today is a special production with KCMJ-FM in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And KCMJ serves a community that includes Fort Carson and Shriver Air Force Base, Peterson Air Force Base, NORAD, the Air Force Academy, and really a large number of military retirees who have chosen to live in Colorado Springs. And today's production is really special because our guest is the first female four-star general in U.S. history, and she managed over 69,000 armed service personnel and an annual budget over $60 billion. And to put it bluntly, our guest, before she recently retired, commanded the entire U.S. Army's global supply chain, and she's written a book, and I've read this book cover to cover. It's a terrific book, and it's called A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General, and her name is Anne Dunwoody. Anne, welcome to KCMJ and the Tim Danahy Show.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be here.
Well, I have to be honest. We talked off air, and already, you had me a general. You're a delightful person, and your book is wonderful. And there's so many insights, so many things that we need to talk about. But contrary to the title, Anne, you mentioned throughout this book, you stress that you didn't become the Army's first female four-star general, but rather you praise the Army for creating an environment. Really, an environment of opportunities that allowed you, who happened to also be the most capable person, a female, to fill the position. Can you explain?
Yeah, you know, when I joined the Army, Tim, back in 1975, and it's hard for people to fathom, I joined the Women's Army Corps. And that was kind of a separate women's corps from the Army for women who desired to serve. And so throughout my almost 38 years in the service, what I witnessed was that the doors continued to open for women, and not without confrontation and not without obstacles and roadblocks, but also with people that wanted to help. And so as I look back on this wonderful journey that I got to experience, I had the opportunity to walk through many doors, kick some down some doors, had some doors open for me. And so I credit the Army for the timing is everything, but they gave me the experience, the assignments, the professional opportunities that made me and gave me the credibility, the reputation, and the tools that I needed to be qualified for this position.
Well, Anne, you really paid your dues. I mean, you came in, you had steadily increasing responsibilities, and you had this wonderful support of an initial, I don't think he was a commanding officer by the ranking structure, but a guy named Wendell Bowen at Fort Sill. How did he get you on a right path?
He was certainly not my commander. He was my very first platoon sergeant, and I was second lieutenant Ann Dunwoody. And when I went to Fort Sill, you never know. They just started the integration of women into the regular Army. So this was a new adventure. They didn't have a lot of female platoon leaders, and you never know how you're going to be received. You could have been, oh yeah, this is a man's army. But that's not Wendell Bowen. Wendell Bowen had been to Vietnam. He was a professional. There's nothing broken about him. He embraced me. He told me he was going to make me the best platoon leader in the Army, not the best female platoon leader. And then he gave me such invaluable lessons that were enduring for me throughout my military career. Things as simple as never walk by a mistake. Now, what he said is if you walk by a mistake, you just set a new lower standard. And you think about that, whether it's not wearing your headgear when you're supposed to or not cleaning your weapon to standard. In the military, not meeting the standard can lead to injury, fatalities, and it's a slippery slope. Organizations, all of a sudden, it's okay not to wear, it's okay not to clean your weapon, it's okay, but it's not acceptable. And so it's a lesson that applies not only to military, but every organization you can think of. I mean, if in GM, if they had identified that defective part instead of ignoring it, look, the millions of dollars they could have saved and maybe lives. In the VA, instead of covering up the delays, if they had highlighted delays for veterans care, they may have been able to help a lot more instead of hurt those veterans. So I think the principle has certainly became a founding principle of my leadership style.
Well, you got off to a good start at Fort Sill, but really it goes back before then, Ann. I mean, your family really has a proud history of serving in the Army. But what's kind of funny is that you didn't really plan on spending more than just a couple of years in the military. What compelled you to stay?
You know, it is funny because I have four generations of my military West Pointers in my family, and it never occurred to me growing up to enter or join the military, even wanted to. I like being a brat, but I always wanted to be a phys ed major and a coach, and I was a tomboy. I loved sports. I played them all my entire life. I went to one of the best physical education schools in the country, Sunny Cortland in New York, and I just knew that was my calling. And my junior year in college, right after Vietnam, they were trying to recruit women coming out of college into the Army because they couldn't go to West Point and there really wasn't ROTC. And so if you got accepted in this program, they paid you $500 a month during your senior year in college with a two-year commitment and a commission as a second lieutenant. $500 a month was a lot of money back then. And it was an offer too good to refuse. And I thought, well, I can do anything for 2 years. I can stand on my head for 2 years. And this will be a little two-year detour en route to my coaching and teaching profession.
Well, whenever you were in there, Ann, you said something in your book, and you said that you discovered that the military not only encourages soldiers to meet their standards, but also rewards those who exceed them. One would think, being outside the military, that you're kind of thinking, well, you know, there's this very rigid structure in there, but really you felt it to almost be liberating. Is that a fair comment?
It is. And, you know, and when I joined as a female, I just assumed that in order to gain credibility and that I would have to exceed the standards, whatever they were. And being a physical education major and very fit athlete, that was not hard for me. But I just assumed I would have to do that. And what I found, and you can imagine, not everyone wants the best athlete, so to speak. But really, in the military, you do want the best. You want the best shooter. You want the fastest runner. You want the one that can do the most push-ups, because this is a dangerous profession. And so you don't want the guy or gal that just meets the standard. You're looking for those that exceed the standards, because our profession demands, very demanding, very rigorous. And so we encourage and reward those who exceed the standards. And I did find that to be very exciting and liberating.
Well, we look at this, and you say you want to exceed the standards. And, of course, not everybody can be A students, you know. But that's where your leadership lessons really came in. And, you know, there's kind of like the C students. You have the 10%, I believe, that you said excel, 10%. You know, they are what they are. But you learned something about average performers, C students, and you related a story of Sal Ginta that potential is in all of us. Can you mention that and how his qualities can be nurtured within the Army?
Yeah, I think if you look at almost all of our Medal of Honor winners, which Sal Ginta was, you know, he came from just a normal family, joined the Army. But the challenge of leaders in the Army is to bring in these young men and women and allow them really to be the best they can be. And they don't even know, I didn't even know, what potential resides inside of me and probably them as well. But our job is to, there are standards for everything, how fast you run, how many push-ups you do, how you wear your hair, your uniform. And you can come in and meet the standard, or you can come in and try to exceed, run faster, do more push-ups, shine your boots, have your hair look cracked, you know, or you can look average. And the ones that look cracked, if we as leaders reward that behavior, then it encourages the ones to, you know, want to be like them. If you don't do anything about the students or soldiers that don't even meet the standards, and that's okay, that becomes okay, it's like never walking by mistake, then there's no incentive for people not to want to try to be better. So that's a 10% at the bottom, 10% at the top. In the middle, 80%, they're looking both ways. And if you reward the good, they want to be like the good. But if you don't discipline the ones that aren't meeting the standard, there is no incentive to be better.
Well, what was cool about your management and your leadership style that applied to making people better that I thought was kind of neat, and it's not consistent among people, really. You had clear statements about right and wrong, and again, it gets never passed by a mistake. But reward and oddly forgiveness and rehabilitation before punishment. How does that help create effective leadership?
Well, you know, someone says there's a fine line when you tell someone they're making a mistake or not. And I said, not really. If someone's making a mistake, that doesn't mean you fire them. It might be because they didn't know what the standard was. So you can make an on-the-spot correction, which is part of the education, and now they know what the standard is. Or, you know, sometimes mistakes are blatant, but you determine that as you get to know the soldiers. But the most thing is to correct, make on the spot, and hopefully incentivize them to know what the standard is. And in the military, I'd say we're a self-policing organization. And if you correct, others correct. And if you don't, and everyone turns a blind eye, the organization, it is a slippery slope, and lower standards become the norm. Whereas if everyone knows what right looks like, and they reward that behavior and take care of those that are not meeting that standard, then you find an organization that wants to excel and is proud of who they are.
Well, Anne, we have to do something that a lot of radio shows have to do, and we have to take a break. And when we come back, there's so much more to talk about, and not only just the leadership style, but just, you know, a bunch of things that I've talked about off air that I had to kind of warn you that I was hoping I could go and discuss, and you were gracious enough to say, oh, okay. But we're talking with the former four-star Army General Anne Dunwoody. We're talking about her new book, A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. And this is a special production of the Tim Danahy Show and KCMJ FM in Colorado Springs, and we'll be right back. Our government should be open. It must be accountable to the people. And we demand access to vote and our votes be counted and verified. These concepts should be common sense in our democracy, but they're not. Some would deny us these rights. But people died for them, and Common Cause works every day to make certain they did not die in vain. Join Common Cause. Keep your rights and hold political power accountable where it should be. The people. CommonCause.org. Holding power accountable. Welcome to this episode of Danahy.com's American History Minute, a one-minute story about little-known events. Today's story comes from Patrick O'Donnell, author of Dog Company. Here's today's story. After D-Day, U.S. forces were advancing faster than supply lines. We needed food and munitions to replenish our men. We needed the French seaport of Brest, but it was fortified with 50,000 German troops ringed with minefields and pillboxes. The heart of the defenses was the Locrist Battery, massive guns surrounded by concrete bunkers. These guns defended the port of Brest. On September 6, Lieutenant Bob Edlin noticed a small footpath through the minefield the locals used to supply one of the pillboxes. Edlin and three men surprised the Germans inside, and they surrendered without a shot. Edlin asked one German, "Will you lead us to the Fort Commandant?" "Yes," he said. So Edlin and one man marched through the front door, the subterranean corridors, and stunned Germans to the main office. The shocked commandant sat at his desk. Edlin said, "Why don't you just surrender the whole fort and get this over with?" The commandant said, "There's two of you and 800 of us." Edlin put a grenade between the commandant's legs. "Surrender now or I release the grenade." The commandant paused, got on the public address system, and ordered the fort to surrender. Lieutenant Edlin and one man captured the entire Locrist Battery and opened the French coast to resupply the Allied invasion of Europe. This story has been provided by the Tim Danahy Show. Please like us on Facebook at Tim Danahy Show and follow us at Twitter at hashtag Tim Danahy Show. And thank you for listening at Danahy.com. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and this is a special production with KCMJ-FM in Colorado Springs, and it's a special production because we're talking with former four-star General Ann Dunwoody, and we're talking about her book, A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. And she's a delightful person, I have to tell you that. We talk on air, we talk off air, and she's good. And Ann, I understand you have a shout-out for us.
Yes, Tim, let me start right off. Denver South High School, to the Junior ROTC program, first to each and every member of the Junior ROTC, I am so proud, and I congratulate you for taking on this opportunity to learn more about leadership and more about the military. And to First Sergeant Blanton and Colonel Meek, thank you for your leadership. These young men and women, there's no greater treasure.
And thank you so much for doing it. And they are good people, and they should be proud of themselves the same way that you are proud of them. So thank you for that. Your book on leadership, I mean, it talks about life in the Army. There are some nitty-gritty kind of things in there, but permeating this whole wonderful book are different aspects of leadership. And you stressed at one point that you were a big believer in accountability, you know, people and property and actions. Can you explain that? Because that'll kind of lead us into a couple other subjects, too.
Sure. Some things like never walk by a mistake start real early in your career. And when I was a platoon leader with Sergeant Bowen at Fort Sill, the property book officer was actually relieved. That was the person, lieutenant, responsible for the accountability of property in the company. This is a maintenance company and the first sergeant. And they were relieved because they were fighting over property that should have been disposed of properly, but they wanted to retain it for themselves personally. And they didn't have the right paper trails and accountability for the property in the company. And so they really... And Sergeant Bowen and I were selected to become the new, I was the proper book officer and he was the proper book NCOIC. And we spent months trying to account for tools, mechanic toolboxes, vehicles, installation property, months and months to get it accounted for, know what the shortage were, and get the stuff on order in accordance with regulation. And that was my first exposure to lack of accountability and accountability of our property and being good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars. Now, you remember this is right after Vietnam, very little dollars for training or funding, and so it was a very challenging time, kind of the broken army. So that was my first exposure, and that became one of my mantras, that we must be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars, and every assignment, whether it's company in the next level, accounting for, documenting property for our military and accounting for losses and holding people accountable for losing property or destroying property. Then it was battalion command. And ultimately, at the my final assignment as the AMC commander, getting visibility, asset visibility over property as we became a military motion, I would say, deploying to Afghanistan and to Iraq and the Horn of Africa, people and equipment were in motion, and we didn't have the tools, the automated tools, to keep account of the property, even as late as the deployment into Desert Storm. And you remember the Iron Mountains, containers stacked up. We returned 20,000 containers of equipment back from Saudi Arabia that had never been opened. We didn't know what was in them. We didn't know where they're supposed to go because we didn't have the automated tools to keep track of this stuff. And we swore that would never happen again. But funding priorities kept shifting, and they tend to go to the combat equipment, sexy bullets, and right, you know, those are all important things. But we had to have the automated tools to account for this probably $260 billion, I would say, enterprise, instead of hand receipts, paper, you know, I'd say spreadsheets and toilet paper, but that's this crew. But we did not have the automated capability to track ourselves, and that became a mantra, a journey in and of itself to get that accountability system for our Army.
Well, that was really, and it's funny, you're kind of hitting the points ahead of me here, and I appreciate that. I'll always make the radio show host look like he knows what he's doing, even when he doesn't. But because one of the things that you stress is courage, and you really wrestled with. You wanted to reform this process, this Iron Mountain, this incredible waste. You wanted to reform that, but you had to go over people's heads and get the attention of higher ups. You kind of like, I won't say broke ranks, but this is something that you believe strongly and ultimately were vindicated, correct?
That is correct. And I tell everybody, you know, especially in a bureaucratic organization and in places like the Pentagon, and it's hard, it's a bureaucracy. And many people can say no, very few people can say yes. And so I told people, don't be discouraged by the first no. Make sure if you're passionate about something, if you believe in something, you have to get that decision to the person ultimately responsible for the yes or no answer. And in this case, we have levels you go and you make your case and they go, oh, yeah, that's really important, and then they don't fund it. And yes, you're right. Then you go to another level and say, well, I gotta take it up. And you plead your case and it goes, yeah, that's really important. And then nothing happens. And in this case, finally, ultimately, I had to go to the chief of staff of the Army because ultimately he's the one that had to make a decision whether or not this deserved the funding priority over other things and everything. There's always more requirements than there is money. And so when I brought the case to him, he knew. He knew we had to have this automated system. He knew that we were wasting money by not being able to, well, now he knew, not being able to see what we had. If you don't know what you have and where it is, then you have to buy more of it to send it over to Afghanistan. And if you can't see that you already have it there. And so this system, once we got visibility and got approval and got funded, allowed us to see our equipment, the condition it was, where it was, where we had excesses, where we had shortages, where we could move the equipment around to the need. And when we had the surge in Afghanistan, 50% of the equipment that supported that surge in Afghanistan came out of Iraq because we could see it. Instead of shipping it or buying it back in the United States, we were able to see what we had. We were drawn down in Iraq. We knew what condition it was in, and we were able to repair. And so the power of having a capability like that paid for itself tenfold. But it also shows that you just, if you believe in something, it's worth fighting for than fight for it.
Well, I won't go into this, but your brother, I'm going to leave it for people to buy the book and to read page 97, but your brother Buck had a story in there, and there's a fine line between courage and stupid, and it was a great story because that's something that my wife and I have discussed. It was wonderful, and we don't need to embarrass Buck on international internet radio, but trust me, it's a wonderful story. And you moved up. You moved up, you know, the various, you got more and more stars, and you mentioned on page 111 that the decisions get harder as you get promoted. And you put it in the context of cyclical funding of the military. And you said there is no peace dividend. And you used terms like touch and stay army. You said we can't unplug. What's the context for that? And what's the significance of it?
It was my experience as I looked at the funding cycle, and you can go back to World War II. The way the military gets funded is when there's a war, the money pours in, and you have the money you need to do and buy what you need. And the height of the war, maximum funding, as soon as there's a hint that the war's over, it's not a gradual, methodical drawdown of funds. It's a drastic reduction of funds. And every time we have done that, it's resulted in a significant or drastic consequence. And I think about Task Force Smith in Korea, an untrained, unfunded, unready army trying to win a war that we're not capable of doing, a hollow army that resulted after Vietnam because reduced funding, reduced training, reduced equipment. My brother, who was good buck in Germany, was riding on golf carts and using broomsticks for rifles. You know, this while we're trying to prepare for the fold the gap, you know, it's. And so you see these reductions, the hollow army, it took us 10 years to recover from that. And thank God for NCOs like Sergeant Bowen, and who rebuilt this great army to the great army that it is. And now here we see it again. It's a cyclic thing. Height of the war, we had money, OEF, Operation Enduring Freedom, and Operation Iraqi Freedom. The money we needed to buy what we needed, as fast as we needed, as much as we needed. And now a drastic cut, and you hear the services with saying, gosh, if it happens like this, we risk breaking the army, hollowing out the army, not being prepared for the next fill-in-the-blank contingency. That's scary to me.
Well, just in a historical context, we were similarly unprepared prior to World War II, and I think Harry Truman really had to scramble to even provide rifles and uniforms for our men right immediately before the Korean War. So that does illustrate the problems that you're talking about by extreme cycles of military spending. But Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was mentioned twice in your book, and he said that we had to put a cap on the number of people in Afghanistan, and that caused some problems. And I should mention that we've had Ambassador Christopher Hill on, and we've had Brent Scowcroft's biographer, official biographer, I guess would be a way to put it, on the show, and their enthusiasm for Donald Rumsfeld perhaps. Is not as great as yours. But I will mention simultaneously, General Ray Odierno is highly respected. They had good things to say about him. The political influence of military and undeclared wars, the political influence on fighting wars is a very challenging thing for our military, isn't it?
Well, we understand civilian control of the military. And the military and our senior leaders, the chairman and the joint chiefs, are responsible to give their best advice and counsel to the civilian leadership. And then we don't get to make those decisions. We don't get to decide on the cap or how many are going. Once a decision is made, it is our job to execute the strategies that are planned. And so if someone disagrees violently with that and wearing the uniform and can't live with the decision, they have choices, stay or go. But the decisions are made by the civilian leadership after giving our best advice and guidance. And that's the nature of our business. And that's not going to change. So depending on the leadership and their, political views and their decisions, the military becomes the executional arm of that.
Well, I'll tell you what, Anne, let's take another break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about your retirement and post-retirement and some of your reflections, if we could, because, it's like we've had former senators on the show, and whenever they look back, nothing's better than a retired politician, and I'm going to assume there's nothing better than a retired general, too.
All right, I thought it was a recovering politician.
rehabilitated. We're talking with former General Anne Dunwoody. She was with the U.S. Army, and we're talking about her book, A Higher Standard: Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. And you're listening to her here on the Tim Danahy Show, the special production with KCMJ Colorado Springs. And we'll be right back. We, the people of the United States of America, reject the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United ruling and other related cases, and move to amend our Constitution to firmly establish that money is not speech, and that human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. Go to movetoamend.org. Add your voice to the 350,000 people who say, enough. This is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com. And today we have a special production with KCMJ-FM in Colorado Springs. And hello to all the good people at Fort Carson and Peterson and Shriver Air Force Base and NORAD and the Air Force Academy. Because we're talking with retired four-star General Ann Dunwoody. And we're talking about her book, A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies for America's First Female Four-Star General. And again, I iterate that you know, I'm talking with her on air and off air, and she's absolutely delightful. But Ann, I must say that you have one fatal flaw, and I need to bring this to your attention. Are you sitting
Guess
down?
What? I'm happy about that.
Okay. Yeah. As a lifelong St. Louis Cardinal fan, I find this this blind allegiance that you have to the New York Yankees somewhat upsetting. You know, and I think they have 12-step programs for that.
You know, when you get to throw out the first pitch, it does something to your heart, you know, with the Mets and the Yankees. It was all fun.
Yeah, well, you know, one would think that the pitcher, A.J. Burnett, would have been a little bit more enthused than what he was through your account. And so I guess that's part of the reason he was shipped out to Pittsburgh or something. But but in regards to your Yankees and my Cardinals, I'll always have 1964. So I forever hold that year in my heart.
And it might be the last, but it's a good one.
It could be. It might. But, you know, we're talking quite a bit about, you know, the military. You're in charge of the global logistics for the U.S. Army, and we're talking $60 billion, 69,000 people. I mean, if they need a bullet in Afghanistan, ultimately you're responsible for that. And an extraordinary responsibility and you know, extraordinary ethics required to make it work. But when you retired, you were called back for your ethics, essentially. And part of it was that there was an ethical crisis in the military. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think for anyone wearing the uniform, when someone in uniform violates the code or does something unethical, especially a senior leader, it feels like a kick in the gut, because that uniform that we wear, this profession, I'm not saying that means you're perfect, but it says that you are held to a higher standard. You take oath. You're subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and there's standards for everything we do. And you expect, particularly young kids that you're trying to coach, mentor, and train to become part of this this profession, that there's going to be mistakes along the way and poor judgment, and you're going to help them see the light. And many times, they, you know, those soldiers, just like myself, who came in for two, find the camaraderie, the values, the institution, a lifelong journey. But when you see senior leaders that get caught up, and in my book, I kind of describe, this is a little off the first topic, but the kinds of people I worked with, advocates, Janus Facers, and detractors. And so you can't assume that everyone you're going to work with is an advocate of you. And when I had many, many more advocates that, and these were men who either believe in you or don't, but they did, and encouraged and inspired and gave me opportunities if left the system I would never have. There's people that are patronizers, or what I call Janus Facers, where they say one thing to your face, and this is not just the military, it's every organization. I'm sure you've seen your share of all three categories. And then there's people that, detractors, that I would say, that just don't, this is a man's world, you don't belong here, I don't like you, I don't even know you, but you don't belong here. My line is, my story, and I believe that to deal with these people, you have to know what kind you're dealing with, and then you stay on the moral high ground. You don't lower your standards. You don't begin name-calling or innuendos or any of that stuff. You stay on the higher standard. You demonstrate you're professional. You show them you're capable, and you can convert. So just talking about people in general, you're going to deal with these kinds of folks. Then you get into what happens sometimes to these great leaders. is they fall off the good leader wagon, as I say, and do things because all of a sudden they believe they can either get away with it or the law doesn't apply. And again, this is not just the military. You see it in all walks of life, people who think they're above the law or their authority or their position gives them special authorities that are outside the realm of the code. And it's destructive. It destroys the trust and foundation that this very profession operates on. And so when you see that behavior, it is a concerning. And the session was called to talk about, boy, we're seeing a rash of these in senior leaders right now, of these unethical behavior. What's causing it? What do we do about it? And how do we stomp it out? And that's what I love about this military. It's a continuous learning, self-policing. We didn't just turn the other way, say, I've got an issue, and we're going to deal with it.
Well, what was neat about your retirement, and that's kind of a strange way to refer to a retirement, isn't it? Something neat about it, or something really good about you, Anne, is when you retired, you were approached by, it sounds like you had a lot of offers from academia and corporations, including defense contractors. And you have this wonderful ethical foundation. I mean, it goes all the way back to your father at West Point, that kind of thing. And, you took that kind of slow and weren't too wild about that. But do you have concerns about the revolving door between defense contractors and retired military officials?
I think there's pretty clear rules about, your time and your distance that you have to keep and not looking out for your next career while you're still involved with, especially in my business, defense contracts were part of the team. And I think sometimes we tend to categorize people, defense contracts are bad, got the money hand in your pocket, these people are good. But it's not. There's good, bad, and ugly in every profession. And mostly there's good in every profession, but the few bad apples seem to always ruin it, and they get all the publicity. And so you be on guard for the few bad apples. But in general, I believe there's good folks in all walks of life, in the defense contracting side, in the military side. They know what they're supposed to do, what the rules are, and most people, they try to abide by those rules.
Well, you mentioned kind of like I won't say a reorganization, but kind of a restructuring with procurement procedures. And you wrote pretty strongly, Anne, about three kings, three wise guys, and the three wise asses. And it is okay to say wise asses on internet radio. And you talked about their concentrated purchasing power, and they had a combat mindset, you said. And you said they were focused on buying military hardware. Are you completely satisfied with that that's a good way to oversee the purchasing in the military?
Now, I think that's changed now. And that was then. You have to share the perceptions, right or wrong. That was my view. These were three military officers in the Army. That was the Army's way of forming a group, right or wrong. This is how they chose to do that, to prioritize funding. And in many ways, if you were chief staff advisor, it makes good sense. You have the budget guy. You have the Army budget office person, you have the G3 who's operations. Those seem like the three likely people to help sort out these really tough, monetary funding decisions and prioritize them. And like my chapter on diversity, if you don't have a diversified group helping to make those decisions, then you have a tendency to have a different answer or a solution to a problem than if you had a more diverse group, different backgrounds, different lenses, coming up with the recommended solution or priorities. Now, did they have time to do that? I don't know. All I know is what I saw is that it seemed to be very, not all-encompassing way to get after some of the primary priorities, which is, in my case, was the funding for a logistics automation system that could help us see ourselves. And so the part of that discussion was more about the diversity of your leadership team. And it's not about having one of these or one of those. It's having the best one of these and the best one of those, and making sure that when you're in a decision-making group, do you have the best of the best at the table? Or are those best of the best outside the room? And that's what I saw. And many times I would be the only female in the room, and it's hard to be heard sometimes, and sometimes it's not. But I realized, what I realized was that as I pulled my teams together and I looked around the table around me, I wanted to have the best of the brightest of a diverse group of thinkers to help me come up with the best solutions.
Well, your style, your strength, there's always a strength in diversity, and you're quite adamant about that in the book, and you were able to illustrate that, and it was kind of refreshing. And then I have one more quick question before we go to our last break, if we could, and I'm keeping you late, Ann, I know that, and I want to apologize, but I'm not sincere with my apology, because I'm really enjoying this. So if I said I apologize strongly, I'd be lying to you, but I am very appreciative, and that's sincere. But Ann, you wrote of the Army Material Command, the AMC, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier too, and you said it evolved from its original mission in 1962. And you wrote, and I quote, "Over time, much of its work has been focused on the nation's industrial base, the factories and depots that are vital for producing military hardware, vehicles, supplies, and ammunition. Does the United States have a problem with our industrial base?"
I worry about our industrial base. And when we, at the height of Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, our industrial base had responded so well and was doing three times the work it was doing during Vietnam. And so we geared up. They were able to respond. It took a while. So this is the being anticipative instead of reactive, but they were able to do that. And then once they got the wheels in motion and the depots operating, the arsenals going full speed and the ammo plants in sync, they were humming like a fine, well-oiled machine, as you would say. Then comes the cuts and the reductions. And when you don't have a strategy of what you need to preserve, what capabilities you have to preserve, and you take the salami slice approach that everyone gets a 15% cut, I do worry about the capabilities we need, not for the last war, but for the next war. What capabilities are now OBE, and what are the future requirements, like smart munitions, not dumb munitions, like cyber warfare, not old, you know, landline stuff. So you have to take a look and make conscious decisions of where you have excess capacity now due to no longer needing those requirements, and that's always hard, and where you have new requirements and where you need to transition or convert old capability skills into new requirements for the future.
Well, I'm glad that you acknowledge that. I think that's a very important thing, Ann, so thank you. And that's a very important, just one of many important passages in your book. And we need to go to our last break, and then we're going to talk about a couple things that, you know, it's amazing the action of a book that exists in the afterwards. And I have to ask you a couple of questions out of your afterword in your book, because it really was thought-provoking. We're talking with Ann Dunwoody, a former four-star general, Ann Dunwoody, about her book, A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. You're listening to her here on the Tim Danahy Show, and it's a special production of KCMJ-FM in Colorado Springs. We'll be right back. You preserve a nation one community at a time, with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join us today, coffeepartyusa.com. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we have a special production with KCMJ-FM in Colorado Springs today, and we're just having a wonderful conversation with retired four-star general Ann Dunwoody, and we're talking about her book, A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. And Ann, let me just say, first of all, not only a delight it is to talk with you, but what an honor it is. After reading your book and thoroughly enjoying it, the opportunity to be able to talk with you honestly and enjoyably about such an interesting book, it's really a privilege. So thank you very much.
Oh, God, I'm honored. Thank you.
Well, it is sincere. A couple things. You retired, and the afterword of your book is interesting, but there's one more thing I wanted to talk about retirement from the military, because I wanted to mention a general Ronald Fogelman. And you retired, and you said you were comfortable with your decision, and you even cited General Fogelman. I thought he was pretty cool. Can you give the listeners a snapshot of that, his retirement?
Yeah, Ron, General Fogelman, it's hard for me because he was senior to me, ever call him Ron. That's just our protocol.
That's okay.
he was a wonderful chief of staff, and he didn't feel like he was getting the support he needed or that his advice and counsel was being taken by the civilian leadership. And that made him worry that he was not going to be as effective for his Air Force as he could be if he thought that his recommendation and his counsel was being taken in the way that he presented. To his credit, and I admire him, and this is why I cited him in the book, that he decided to be the first chief of staff to ever choose to resign, to retire early before his four-year tenure, because he thought that because his voice was not being heard, he was not as effective as chief of staff as he wanted to be. And I thought, wow, that takes a lot of courage to be able to make that decision, because it's the most prestigious job, as you can imagine, chief of staff of the Air Force. And having the responsibility of training, manning, equipping the entire Air Force and airmen and airwomen. And so to make that decision on his own willingly and ask for that to be removed because he didn't feel like he was being heard, I just thought, how impressive. And it made me think a lot about retirement and, you know, doing it on your own terms. And sometimes we do, but the military is not an institution that normally facilitates on your own term. Usually you don't get promoted, or you don't get the next assignment, or you don't get, and then you go, oh, I have to retire. But for people to do that, especially at that level on their own, was very made a big impression on me.
Yeah, it really was cool, and I mentioned to you off air that it kind of reminded me of Douglas MacArthur, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And so General Fogelman's retirement, there was a sweetness in his conduct and a nobility, truthfully, to it.
Absolutely.
You know, an aged warrior, if we could put it that way, and there's no no dishonor in that whatsoever. In your afterword, which was really thought-provoking, and I could probably do a show on every subject, but unfortunately time does not allow such a thing. You advocate a national service for every 18 to 20-year-old, just 1 year that every person can serve the country in some way. And I know you mean many different alternative terms of service that people could do. But I want to broaden that, or perhaps narrow it just a little bit. How would you feel about a reinstatement of the military draft to serve our nation? And if they got rid of deferments, do you think that would enhance the possibility of peace?
I can get your last question, though. I heard the draft part, and I could ready to respond, but I didn't hear the last line there.
If we didn't have deferments, if everybody had equal chance of serving in the military, do you think that would enhance the possibility of peace?
Oh, okay. Let me start with the national service into the draft. I personally am not a fan of the draft. It served its purpose, and then it also had some downsides. I don't think everyone is cut out to serve in the military. But I do think everyone's cut out to do something for this country that makes them feel part of this great country, whether it's helping the home. That's the national service piece that I was so blessed to join with General Stan Retired McChrystal and Walter Isaacson, who co-chair the Franklin Project, sponsored by the Aspen Institute. And they have got great traction, and they've got a lot of support. 4+1 colleges where you do your year of service, year before you go to college, year after you go to college. Businesses are investing in this thought. And when you think about our nation, our population, that only 3 out of 10 men in the age of 18 to 23, it is, are eligible to come into the military. That's not a military problem. That's a national issue, because they're either overweight, don't meet the standard, not high school graduate, incarcerated, you fill in the blank. That's a scary statistic to me. And if we can get young people to feel part of this great country in some way, to give, not free, where they have stipends, they're figuring out ways how to bring kids in. And there are a lot of kids doing a lot of great things already, but we want to make it a mandatory opportunity for everybody, that they want, they'll want to do that, and raise the level of patriotism in this country. The draft, I said I'm not a fan because I'm not, I don't believe everyone is cut out. This is a dangerous profession, and I think there's a lot of wonderful people in the military, but I think that we can find ways for our youth to give back to this great country other than just serving. So that was that. And deferments and peace, I don't know.
Okay. That's okay. Another thing that was in your afterword, and this gets to my terrible nature and everything, and you kind of suggested that politicians are kind of unpredictable with their military funding, and because of their unpredictability, a lot of spending is inefficient and wasteful. And, and naturally you advocate that there be adequate expenditures to wisely sustain military preparedness. But Anna, I look at it and I say, you know, we're spending more than the next 26 nations combined on our military, and 25 of those nations are our allies. Is that sustainable?
I think there's a combination there of being predictable, being efficient, and being effective. And what we have with things like, I mean, look at the words we use now, sequestration, government shutdown. You know the inefficiencies that those things cause. When you terminate a contract, that costs more money. You lose skill sets, and then you have to bring them back. That costs more money. I mean, it's a vicious cycle. The way we're doing it, some of the inefficiencies it creates, the priorities that we have, it's probably the most dangerous world we've ever seen, and yet we can't predict. We're living on contingency funding, not predictable funding, and it's just, it seems an insane way to fund defense, and I think that contributes to some of the inefficiencies there.
So perhaps if we had some predictability amongst our politicians, we might be able to establish a workable baseline that would save money for everybody, really, if I'm kind of reading into your answer. We could do it better, perhaps, if we were more predictable.
Yeah, I mean, how many they plan for about, we'll have this budget if we get this much, we'll have this budget if we get that, if we're going to get this, I mean, we're spending so much time planning for this or that, that it's maybe a waste of time instead of going, the budgets are going to be this, and you're right, they've increased and we've gotten used to a lot of money, and you're right, there's a culture, probably the last 10 years, I think about people that came into the military. Not in the Vietnam days when I came in, when you didn't have a little, you know, every penny counted, where you had this flush of money because we wanted to make sure our soldiers had the best, the fastest, and the most recent piece of equipment, and rightfully so. And that is not an affordable strategy. We need to be sure they have what they need, when they need it, and the amounts that they need. And so the war created a strategy that's definitely not sustainable. And that was, we need it, get it fastest way. I mean, flying stuff in, you know, much more expensive than shipping stuff. So we had a strategy of trying to sustain it that's not sustainable. Unaffordable is a better word.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes one wonder, you know, if it was predictable, they could say, well, just it makes you think if you're afraid of a cut, you're going to try and grab as much as you can right now in order to prepare for the lean days. But if it was predictable, you could manage it better. And I have one more question, I promise, and it's another one of those irritating kind of things that I ask, but it's also praise to you. And that is in your afterword, which again, a great book and a powerful afterword, you admitted the difficulty of fighting undeclared wars and identifying enemies. And what would you recommend in that case?
Yeah. And there's a lot on TV talk shows now and a lot of folks talking about, you know, who is the enemy? And we seem to be a little, we refuse to identify the enemy. You know, when we were fighting communism and the ideology, we knew what we were fighting. We knew who we were fighting. And now we seem afraid to identify who the enemy is. And that makes it awful hard to, you know, consolidate on the objective and go after the enemy who we define as the enemy. And it could be an ideology, but we just seem to, it's this today and it's this tomorrow day, and you can't use that word and you can use this word and not in that form. And who is the enemy? Let's define it, and then we'll know how to fight it.
Well, Anne, I want to say just one other thing too, and I know that, you know, we should never go there. I have one of the great wives on this earth, you know, but I want to say that from reading your book, I think your husband Craig seems like a pretty darn cool guy also, and it would be a shame not to acknowledge him before signing off. He's been a good man, and he seems like he's always been there for you, and that's something very special. And I wanted to get that on the air too, just because we guys have to stick together.
You nailed that one real good. That was a good ad. I am blessed. He's a hero in his own right, and it's not easy being the spouse of a four-star general, but he did it better than anyone I could ever know, and he was my number one fan all the way.
Yeah, and the love and respect really shown through the book too. Just a remarkable book. The book is A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General, and that general is General Anne Dunwoody. And Anne, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Tim Danahy Show, and it's been, Yankee fan notwithstanding, it has been an absolute treat and an honor for me.
My pleasure. Really has been fun. You made it fun. Thank you, and informative.
You're very gracious. Anne Dunwoody, A Higher Standard, here on the Tim Danahy Show with KCMJ. The Tim Danahy Show would like to thank Aaron Taylor of SRC Labs for production management and outreach strategies, and Presonus, a leading designer and manufacturer of audio recording software, hardware, and related accessories available at Guitar Center, for Edward Danahy for post-production assistance, and for all the stations and affiliates who carry the Tim Danahy Show, and lastly, to Theodore, the studio bull terrier, for his quiet companionship.